which I did.
I find so many people aren't at all informed about it. There are other areas of the country. You know,
I think you're right.
They kind of think he's a weird scientist or, a non-person type person that's specialized in one thing. I found that in a lot of people.
Just the rocket genius and sort of a
tunnel
faceless
for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of people ask me what kind of person he is.
And he was a Renaissance man, wasn't he?
He was probably, he's one person I remember as being a person with so very many vast attributes and things, you know. He seemed to drag a total country into his endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a looking way, but in an activity way.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the very beginning he had a way to make people want to work and want to do good. And he had so many ways of creating incentives for people, not monetary, but I'm talking about people feeling good about what they were doing.
Right.
So, I might be plunging in the middle
of this, but... And what an attribute, I mean, that's almost the definition of a leader, isn't it, in spades, who can generate that kind of enthusiasm and followers.
Well, he was a man with visions, you know, and his visions were rather focused as far as exploring the universe and finding out what's out there,
mm-hmm.
and putting energy in to create a place for man too, but he had ways to accomplish those visions. He was flexible. I mean, very flexible as far as having to deal with many kinds of people, you know, politicians,
mm-hmm.
and competitors and peers. And he was so innovative in doing that. I know things like, how do you really get to the moon? That thing bounced along there under debate and studies to the point that his vision was basically to create a station, Earth orbital station. But you know, in working that with all of the adversaries of other concepts, well, he conceded that, okay, we'll go direct. So, but his basic, he wanted to build a platform for orbiting Earth to do that. That gave that would have given a capability we're trying to get to now, you see. And he
thought ahead to Mars and beyond.
And that was all in there. And, you know, and we knew what he was up to as far as concepts, as far as propulsion and vehicles and in ways to do it. But he wanted to build a base that had a future built into it.
Mm-hmm.
But he conceded and took the approach to go direct.
So he was flexible in ratcheting down his dreams,
ratchet,
I guess.
He could ratchet down either any direction and achieve in the visions that, you know, would finally get to in the direction he wanted to go, or in the direction he thought that we should go. And he was extremely meet situations that were sort of irreversible, you know, as time went on. Extremely cooperative. But his cooperative, you know, he's cooperative, but also he took such a leadership role that it was oftentimes they cooperated with the concepts that he derived.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he and burn a lot of bridges?
He didn't burn any bridges, and I noted that all the time I was around him, I never ever heard him say bad about any person, ever.
Hmm.
He never made any kind of offhand remarks about any person or any ethnic groups or anything. It was straight. He had an infinity for life to the point that he had a very high tolerance for all, you know, all people.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an interest in them. I know he'd tell a lot of stories in our, you know, travels. He'd be on a plane or riding in a car or something. And he would give you a lesson in history in many areas. I mean, not just this day and time or not what's going on now, but way back. He had a vast grasp on history and especially geography. He knew a lot about the geography of this world.
Aside from apparently being such a voracious reader, he must have retained everything he ever...
He didn't seem to forget anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know one instance that I knew he didn't forget, because in this was in 1966, I guess it was March in 66. He was always having hideaway meetings, you know, and here in this area, oftentimes go to down on Yonnersville Lake or that area. And
in 66, did you say that?
In 66. And I know at the time, a program manager on all the large engines that went into the launch vehicles for the Apollo program, and it just pretty well... Hello?
We're going to go ahead and go.
Yeah, okay.
I'll find the right striker just to get this little area here in the morning.
Okay.
And we'll see you in the morning.
All right. And at the time, the engine programs, all the engines that were being developed had run through their qualification programs for production, and we had the first ones in production for the very early flights. Well, you know, this thing's going real good now. It's been kind of tough since 60 or when we started. But went down to that sort of hideaway, that weekend meeting, and, you know.
Over in Gunnersville, did you say?
It was on Gunnersville Lake.
Right.
It, one of the fellows owned it that worked out there. The fellow used to work in the PAO office, and he had George Miller down there with him, and some other people, and he had one of the fellows from Washington, which was George, was in the early phases of the studies that led to Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
John Disher, he died two or three years ago, was the begin to talk about the, what they called at the time Apollo Applications Program, that was using some old hardware, tanks and all that to try,
I remember that.
Try to get a station. And they had a study manager at the time in Huntsville. He was in program development office. And so they asked me if I wanted to think about taking the manager job of that Apollo Applications. Of course, it was an unfunded, you know, concept.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess it took until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning time we wound up. And in that process, though, between George Miller and Warner Von Braun, all the things that seemed to be required to make something happen, we went through, reviewed, and all, and they committed that they would back those things happening. And none of the easy ones, the tough ones were like getting some of the right people. I'm
sure.
Talking about top people
mm-hmm.
to come in and help. By golly, you know, over the ensuing years, you know, from 66 to the time that thing really got rolling in 69, not one of those requirements were reneged on. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you didn't work them in paper. You know, none of that was in paper, you know. You had to do it on a one-for-one basis.
Right.
But he had a way to kind of make things happen. It wouldn't happen tomorrow, maybe next month or 2 months later. Things would kind of turn around. But there was absolutely no contract, nothing in writing, but every requirement, basic, you know, speaking. To make that program go was met.
And that was, I mean, you acted on a commitment simply
it
from Von Braun.
It was a verbal commitment between Von Braun and George Miller.
Mm-hmm.
But those two guys, had they not been the people they were, that program would never happen. Because
mm-hmm.
we had people that were really against it, you know, out of other centers.
Sure. So Skylab, of course, derived from that. And what else?
Well, the Skylab, but Skylab brought along with it what derived from that. AAP was a kind of just using a Saturn 1B vehicle with a tank that had the ability to reuse after it was in orbit. We built platforms
mm-hmm.
and all that. But in 68, September 68, we decided jointly between the centers and the scientific community. Homer Newell was the chief scientist at NASA at the time. That was too much of a risk, and you know, to put a lot of energy and effort into, money and effort, and that sort of thing, and from September 68 to March 69, we did studies, and there was a group put together to redefine the program, and we redefined the program, and in March of 69, it became the dry workshop to be launched on a Saturn V with the Saturn 1B delivering the astronauts, you know,
right,
to have it for habitat and all that. But we were fully equipped, but Homer Newell held out that he would not invest the scientific community's energies into it unless we had a total backup.
know, for a minute there, I was thinking wrongly that this AAP program was originated in view of all this leftover hardware, Saturn hardware, you know, everybody knew you were going to have. But gosh, I mean, if you go back in the 60s, there, we hadn't even landed on the moon yet. And it wasn't known that some of these landing flights would be canceled.
Sure.
So this was conceived without the thought of a lot of leftover hardware from canceled flights, canceled missions.
Well, of course, the backbone of the program was built out of the technology that we had in hand, by and large. Of course, the station itself was a piece of launch vehicle hardware. You know, we
what, that was the S2.
That was
what,
the S2 station.
Okay, right.
And the airlock, some of the work on the airlock had been done by Houston in the programs that preceded that, Gemini and then the Apollo program.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built a docking adapter to dock everything to it and have this command service module dock to it. But the science that went into it was new. Most all the science was new. The solar telescope, that was a new piece of hardware.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, was AAP the brainchild of any individual, I mean, such as Von Braun or
yes.
Someone else?
Yes, Apollo Applications would lead you to believe that that was a piece of Apollo program that's getting applied.
Yes.
We could not say space station in any meeting
mm-hmm.
to anyone,
right.
Up the channel, any place. We didn't call it the space station until, well, heck, it was around not over a year or two from the time we lost it.
Mm-hmm.
It was in...
As far as you would go, I guess, officially, was something like an orbiting space laboratory or something like that, wasn't it? Or
well, it was that, yes.
But I meant to avoid the terminology there.
Well, we
space
called
station.
It Apollo Applications right on up. We called
right.
it, a laboratory and you know, benign terms.
Sure.
That are common to down here. But that's the only major program that I know of in NASA that never had a program operating plan approved by Congress.
Hmm. Is that right? The AAP?
Right.
Right.
And what finally became the dry workshop. I still don't know what paperwork what paperwork it was, but it did get a lot of notoriety as far as studies with the right people in the Congress when we went to a dry workshop. But somehow we never had a...
Oh, y'all call that a dry workshop, meaning
all
the propellant had drained out.
The AAP originally was a wet workshop. It had propellants in it when it went up.
Exactly, right.
Hydrogen. And when we had a scheme to vent that and let it dry out. But then we abandoned that and did a dry workshop, which means totally outfitted, dry, you know, no propellants, and launched on a Saturn V as a space station. So
it never got programmatic approval from Congress. Of course, Congress each year okayed the NASA budget, but
right,
as such, it never got this proper official look.
It had, I guess it was part of the Apollo budget in a way, identified for the studies and all. we had the same information, but it was just interesting to note that there was not a POP in Skylab.
Mm-hmm. But the whole program wasn't necessarily the brainchild of Von Braun's. Some collective minds brought to bear there?
Well, yes.
Or out of the Future Projects office? Or?
We had a relationship with Goddard from the science side of things. We had it with JSC, the manned operations. Of course, we had activities throughout the other NASA centers. And Homer Newell, he represented the science and set basically the tone for what science would go, you know. Now there's applications in materials processing and all that that were outside of his realm, of course. But the major science was Homer Newell's. And then there was science in a sense out of JSC as far as the biological study of space on man, you know, on human beings. So they drove that one extremely hard as far as accumulating the kind of data that they felt they had to have a baseline by which one could go from in the future on what the tolerance of the human was with spaceflight. And by the way, the Russians use that baseline to date. You know, they use that one because their data was not that vast as far as compared to what we got on Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we collected every ounce of urine, every ounce of feces, dried feces, and did all kinds of studies and blood tests and all along the way. So we had a comprehensive, the longest mission lasted, which was about 3 months.
Sure.
Up to date. And that gave the Russians a basis to use that as a baseline.
And NASA and y'all shared that with the Soviets?
I don't know. At that time, it was still in the Cold War era.
Sure.
I don't know how they come by their information, but
yeah.
I know.
That's all those Soyuz.
That's what I was.
Happened, right.
I was told that even by Russians later on, as late as 92.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I guess you have a special vantage point to view the space station coming online here.
Sure.
The next generation Skylab.
Sure. You know, it was a basis by which, you know, you dare do that.
You remember any clever quips or comments by Dr. Von Braun about Skylab? Thing was big as a bus, wasn't it?
Well, it's like a 1960s Huntsville three-bedroom house. As far as overall volume,
mm-hmm.
counting all the modules.
Sure.
And the command module. So it was large. You know, the astronauts used the circumference of the workstation to, as a treadmill. They'd run around the circumference of it.
Mm-hmm.
They had a belt they could, you know, kind of a clear space they could run in. Yeah, it was large. It was much larger than what we'll see in the space station for a while. Those diameters are not that large. You know.
Right.
They're only as large as the shuttle will take.
Did you ever see, and it's part of my idea of popularizing the space program, okay, maybe it's space humor, but it draws you into some of the substance of the space program, too.
was kind of a low-key fella. Always willing to do anything he could to help people.
What did Shorston? I think Guy Jackson lived over there in Marshall County, and he was kind of low-key. Well, it doesn't
matter.
Okay.
He might have said something.
I knew most of those guys.
His wife, I think, a few years ago, had Alzheimer's.
Did y'all get into any R&R when you're over there at such meetings? And
well,
did Von Braun, he loved to swim and scuba dive and things like that?
No, they weren't doing any of that. It was an extended work session, I tell you.
Okay, it wasn't much time for
it. You know, they had food. Plenty of time to relax, but in between work. But George Miller was he was as bad as Von Braun as far as working on the weekends. He'd have things all over the country, and he'd show up, and he'd work you right through the weekend.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. He was an expert as far as being able to get people fused together and in a way that you'd come out with agreements on things.
Did he and Von Braun have a pretty good relationship?
Oh yeah, they worked extremely well.
I understand that, and I'm probably not going to delve into this unless it figures into some story, that George Lowe and Dr. Von Braun maybe didn't have the best of relationships. That Jim Fletcher didn't have quite the, well, that's putting it mildly, didn't have the same relationship that Tom Paine and Dr. Von Braun did, for instance.
I don't know. Whatever I'd say, it has to be off the record.
All right. We'll do it that way. All right, I know she had some notes. I will restrain.
Well, that's
myself.
All right. I just thought I'd go over some what I've always known, but in order not to cover too many things twice.
Sure.
Warner was probably, maybe accidentally or without having the credits for it, probably one of the best managers that would fit today's definition of a manager of anyone I've seen.
Is that right?
Well, a manager is basically a person that can motivate his people and delegate to the right people those things that need to be done to get a job done. And he had no dictatorial type modes of management, as far as what it appeared to be. I'm sure he had ways of getting things done without being dictatorial that were more effective, but now, for instance, I was basically in program management from before 60 until I retired, and having programs means you have contractors basically that are contractor. He had subcontractors. He didn't have a structured agenda. You know, he'd listen, and then we had, you know, and we'd, and he'd oftentimes shut off to an associated industry. Like, we'd go to, we had people like GE, and we'd go over and look at their new jet engine developments, and they'd tour you through the plant, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, you had a good exchange of what they were doing, what kind of technology they had going on. And of course, they wouldn't give a secret away.
Sure.
To someone that'd run the plant, but then we would find
and
ourselves.
And this was during the Apollo era?
That was in the 60s, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's really getting the Apollo era, but we did that also in the Jupiter days.
Mm-hmm.
He always did that sort of thing. Jupiter, and even in the Redstone to a great extent. And we'd find ourselves in, say, in Boeing, at their aircraft industry, you know, at their plant, and seeing what kind of activity they had. And sometimes, like in, especially in St. Louis, at McDonnell at the time, they built quite a bit of military fighter type jets, and we'd be there and meeting and being hosted around and looking at all the activities they had going, and you'd find out how he had shunted it off, and how he's out flying with one of their pilots on a new aircraft.
Is that right?
Oh yes, he
mm-hmm.
was you know, he was a real pilot. He loved to fly.
At these aircraft company or aerospace companies,
well, he'd
plants, right?
More than one place, he'd be taking a ride with them in one of their newer, not unqualified, but one of the newer jets. And the thing about Werner in these trips, sometimes he'd be on a trip and he'd be on a side trip, like giving a speech at a medical conference somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And hell, he'd load you in the car and take you along. You know, and you'd meet the people he met.
Right.
You'd be there whatever program he was on, then you'd leave with him. But he did not.
When you were on one of these field trips with him, or
field trips or something similar,
or just because he was going to be in Anaheim to visit an aerospace contractor, I mean, he might go make
same
a medical group talk, and
you'd be in the same general area.
You'd go along.
Right. Sure, he'd take you.
Mm-hmm.
And not always, but often. Like he was a good friend of Walt Disney. I was a resident manager in the later 50s there, and I was living there, so I'd haul him over to Walt Disney's place, you know. He'd go in one of the back door type looking places, and,
mm-hmm.
and he'd go in there, and he didn't set you in the car outside, go in. Of course, you weren't involved in his meeting with Walt, but I guess Walt was getting a lot of ideas from him.
Mm-hmm. On futuristic
sure.
things. Yeah.
Sure, sure. That was
mm-hmm.
that was early on. You know, that was 57 or 8, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That particular time I recall.
Well, they collaborated on that early television series, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, I think so.
Mid-50s or something
I
like
think
that?
So.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure, but I think so. You know, on the way, like if we were going to the West Coast, sometimes we'd sit down in Kansas at one of the aircraft plants out there. into other centers like Edwards Air Force Base. There's always, of course, I have a lot of our engine test work in Edwards Air Force Base, but we're always going over to their experimental activities where they experimented on, well, like U-2s and stuff. Mm-hmm. We weren't showing the U-2 at the time, but
sure.
But he might have known about them. But it was one of those one-of-a-kind opportunities working with such a person to really be able to get on a fast track to know what was going on in the overall business of aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
To meet people that, you'd normally never be able to meet.
Sure.
So he had, I think it was just a natural tendency to do this. I don't think it was by design or by plan that his people just got a heck of a fast-track education on a lot of things.
Mm.
At least that, speaking for myself.
Sure.
Some
others have indicated that.
Well, like in L.A., Rocketdyne, that's North American at the time, was doing most of our engine development. We'd have meetings that even, he went to the corporate level people on things, not to complain, just to communicate, and just to sort of give them the feel for the programs that we were in and what we wanted to do. We'd go over to Atwood and Kindleberger. They were the two top people in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you'd go right along with him. He didn't leave you outside. It was just, and you met people like the old Douglas, Donald Douglas Sr.
Right.
People like McDonald in St. Louis. If you had activities involving that way and you were with him, that you were there.
Mm-hmm.
So it just was one of
fringe.
And
a
that doesn't happen anymore.
Is that right?
I don't think that happens
mm-hmm.
With people anymore. Most people cut off, they have tiers, and certain people handle certain things.
Right.
But not him. He had a way of building a management structure that felt comfortable, with him and in any level that he took you to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think many people knew that kind of thing about him.
I think you're right. But wasn't that wise on his part?
I don't think it was calculated. I think it was just the way he was. And he managed that way in when he was director of our center and when he was director of the Army part of AVMA.
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday we had an all-day program-oriented laboratory director level meeting, and all the programs would give status, but it was usually hinged around problem areas and things that needed to be decided. And his laboratory directors were there to represent their areas, but boy, they would just cross over and it was like a tiger feast sometimes. But it always was in the right spirit.
Right.
But,
was that one of the, somebody's told me that in those kinds of meetings or other management meetings that if you
study was a review of the total activities involving programs of substance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, any other institutional things that were on somebody's mind, they could throw in there. But you would come out of that meeting with a clear understanding of the direction to go.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, you didn't leave anything dangling. Sometimes you'd wind up taking a vote. And if there was a dissent in someone's area, a lab director, someone, or a program guy, well, okay, he had a chance to explain his way out of it if he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But the decisions got made. I mean, they didn't get dangled along, and you didn't have to guess
mm-hmm.
where you were going. And that was every Friday. And you know, it was structured where you didn't change baselines every week. We had a system that was baseline from a commitment point, and you didn't deviate from a commitment point. You could delta from it if you had to, but you never ever forgot the original commitment point.
I see.
Some people shift those commitments, you know, all the time. There's some programs used to do. So, and by his taking the lab directors, the institutional side of the house, the program side together on his round the robin every 6 months or so, that was a cohesive pulling people together too. No one was second guessing others, you know, because they thought someone else might know more than them.
Sure.
Some people contend that in our race with the Soviets, the two big reasons, you know, we won the race to the moon are, of course, the heavy lift launch vehicle prowess that we showed, and program management of vast undertakings, of vast technical projects, you know, such as Apollo, that we just had such a good management system, as opposed to the Soviets, that we succeeded.
That system probably, that's true. I would say that doesn't exist today.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like it today.
I guess
I'm
saying, or
I don't think there's any program in the government like that today. Because every month in Apollo, we would go it would usually be a couple days, series of meetings where we reviewed the total program, and every program manager would have a certain period of time to review their program, and he had. The group that reviewed you were other center directors. Silverstein was there. Newell was there from the science side of the house. And you know, you were subject to review by any of those people that wanted to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people did get some kind of deep briefing before they came to those meetings, if there was problems luring up someplace.
Sure.
So you had to defend your, you know, what you presented to that level of people. And when George Miller took the job of being the director of manned space flight, which was a headquarters position that ran the Apollo program, you could. that guy's eyes. He was sharp.
Mm-hmm.
He had one of those long-term memories too about details. He was just a sharp engineer too. By the way, he's still working, and he's close to 80, I guess.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he's a CEO of a company up in Washington State near Seattle. He's building missiles. I think that's their business.
He's close to Seattle.
Yes. I hear from him about every year. We keep track of him through the AIF activities. And I believe he's here Friday giving a luncheon speech.
He will be here
this
Friday?
He's on the agenda Friday, yes.
At what groups? Oh, wait a minute. No, not at the Von Braun celebration.
No, it's at the... They have a meeting starting today. It runs through Friday. AIAA meeting, I believe it's AIAA down at the Von Braun Center.
Well, I'll be there.
He's a keynote speaker for Friday's lunch.
That's the AIAA.
I believe that's what it is, yes.
I wonder if he's not necessarily going to stay over for the night's festival.
I asked if he was, and I don't think he is. I thought I'd see him Friday, or the 30th, is that Friday?
Right.
I thought I'd see him Friday night, but I inquired with the Space Club, and they said he's not registered to be there.
I may try to contact him, or failing that, ask you later if you have an address where I might write him.
Sure.
I've tracked down Dr. William Pickering.
Yes.
On the West Coast, he's still active in industry.
Right.
And turning wood pellets into fuel source,
okay.
An alternative fuel source. And he was cooperative. He shared one story which I had heard before involving him and Dr. Von Braun that had kind of a humorous twist to it, involving a White House dinner and Von Braun showing up with no white tie at a white tie dinner, and how they dealt with that problem. Didn't get it solved till they got to the White House. And some presidential aide went away with Von Braun, and then Von Braun came back in a little while before they got to the receiving line and had a white tie on, and the president had a black tie on. So Von Braun was left wondering, whose white tie did I wind up getting?
Oh, boy.
But anyway, he said he had fond memories of those days and the Von Braun team and Huntsville and all
that. They worked very close together on getting the first orbiting satellite.
Exactly. Pickering was one of those holding
right
aloft.
Pickering built the satellite, and we had it stored down here for about a year hoping we could launch it.
Right.
That was a real chaotic situation there.
Oh, yeah. That must have been so frustrating to be put on ice.
Well, when you knew you could do it, you had a good launch vehicle that was running good then, and no redstone. And, it was the Vanguard that had to fail three times for
it. You'll be interested in the story on today's front page. John Glenn and Walter Cronkite are running around this week talking about how unreliable Old Reliable was in their fuzzy recollections of it. When Glenn got on top to go,
The redstone?
Now wait a minute, what know Shepard and who, let's see, Atlas was used to launch Gemini. What launched Glenn? Was that a that a redstone? Okay.
We dug a redstone out and went through that with a fine tooth comb.
Okay. But, and our writer, Martin Berkey, is saying, well, the record shows really to the contrary. Once they got past the development phase of the redstone, it was pretty damn reliable.
Oh, yeah,
reliable.
Sure.
But Glenn, not out of malice or anything, but 36 years later or something, was thinking he was sitting on top of a rocket that was crashing all the time. And
well, early days, the old philosophy of rocketry was launch them to find out what your problems were.
Right.
That's what they brought with them.
Mm-hmm.
We soon got to a different approach. We went through the component test qual program and found it in components and then major sub elements.
Hmm. I've never heard that launch, that R&D philosophy expressed just that way.
Well, that's what we did on the early phases in rock in the redstone. We weren't surprised, you know. We built a lot of them. Of course, most people probably don't recognize what we used to do. We had a total in-house capability to conceive, design, test, and build all the hardware in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that from before Redstone until Saturn V booster. We even built the first Saturn V boosters in-house.
That was the old Army arsenal philosophy, and I guess you're saying it was the old Von Braun team.
That's all they
philosophy
knew.
Too.
That's all they
yeah.
knew, you know, they knew that game.
Right.